From Cafe, this is Third Degree. I'm Ellie Honig. Well, welcome back to another of our Friday editions, which I think all the listeners know I really relish because I get to be with one of our brilliant cast of rotating law students. And today, for the second time, I am welcoming back Ellie Nachmani. Ellie, great to see you. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me back, and wonderful time last time, and looking forward to a great conversation today as well.
And so much has happened in just those last 3 weeks. The pace of the news, the pace of the legal news is kind of dizzying. So we will have all sorts of new stuff to catch up on today. Now, I want to start by putting you on the spot for a moment, okay? I'm going to say a word, and I want your, not your law school first impression, I just want your human being first impression when I say this word, okay? Sedition. All right, what jumps into your mind when I say that word, sedition?
So it's obviously a negative connotation, right? I mean, in terms of word association, it would definitely be bad, not good. But sedition calls to mind to me something massive, something, you know, of national significance and concerning, you know, your government and either a foreign government or some sort of, you know, overthrow the government movement. But there's not much good associated with that word.
Yeah, well, decidedly negative in connotation, or I guess that's the right word. But yeah, I think you're right. I think if you ask most people, what do you think of when you think of sedition? They'll think of disloyalty, of things like Benedict Arnold, right? Or Harper's Ferry, the raid on Harper's Ferry down in Virginia. Things like that really sort of had the U.S. government teetering on the brink. And the reason I raise it is because we could be, very soon, we could see sedition charges brought in United States federal court for the first time in a long time. Now, sedition charges are sort of few and far between. Of course, now we're talking about them in the context of the January 6th raid on the Capitol. Michael Sherwin, federal prosecutor with the Department of Justice, gave this interview to 60 Minutes. And I want to talk a little bit later about his decision to give that interview, which I think was wildly misguided and inappropriate. But before we get there, I want to talk about the substance, because he tipped DOJ's hand and then some about where they are on sedition. He essentially said, and I think he all but announced, that sedition charges are quite likely forthcoming in the January 6th case. And the first thing I thought was, well, gee, does it fit? Because when people think of sedition, they think of, as you said, something massive. Was January 6th massive? Sure, in certain sense. Was our entire republic endangered? I don't know that it was ever seriously in danger of that group taking over the entire apparatus of the United States government. If you just look at the law, I will say sedition charges do seem to apply here quite strongly, right? Sedition can mean trying to overthrow the government, but it also can mean less things than that. It can mean trying to interfere with a governmental function, trying to take over a federal building, both of which I think are fairly obviously applicable. What's your view on whether sedition charges, just letter of the law, sort of fit the conduct of at least some of the January 6th rioters?
Yeah, I think it might. You'd have to look at what section of the law you're applying. So there's kind of the, as you mentioned, the broader section, and then there's the more narrow section. But I still think, you know, just in terms of what the letter of the law is, there hasn't been much precedent developed on it. And so the courts have not told us really what, you know, what the law means. And so I think there's room to make arguments both ways. But, you know, I think you make a compelling point that if you just look at the text of the statute, that there may be a case here.
Yeah, and it is very rarely used. It was charged most recently over a decade ago against a Michigan militia. And think about how different these scenarios are, just in terms of the factual circumstances. The last time it was successfully charged was by my old office, the Southern District of New York, in the mid-90s, when they charged Omar Abdel Rahman, known as the Blind Sheikh, with essentially a whole series of terrorist plots to blow up different government buildings, the actual 1993 World Trade Center bombing. So think about how different all three of those scenarios are. I guess to some extent, they all have the same bottom line. There's an interesting prosecutorial decision to be made here about whether you add a sort of more aggressive charge that may be more legally debatable on top of your easier charges, your trespass, your destruction of property. That's a decision we dealt with all the time as prosecutors. I think in this case, there's too important of a public interest to be vindicated. I think if sedition charges do fit, and I think they will fit at least some of the rioters here, I think prosecutors really have an obligation to bring those charges, even if they're a little trickier to prove. What do you make of that?
Yeah. And I think in any prosecutorial decision, the exercise of discretion depends on the goals you're trying to advance. So, you know, as we've talked about with this being applied only in some very factually distinct cases, there is some level of uncertainty when you bring a high powered charge like this, given that it's been 25 years since the Justice Department has successfully prosecuted a sedition case. You know, you usually would fall back on the charges that are more of a slam dunk. Even if the law textually applies to the facts here, there's uncertainty. But, you know, if you want to make a clear statement for the rule of law, maybe this is the direction you go. I think that's going to be a decision for the prosecutor to make.
Yeah. And the risk is you add this sedition charge, which is trickier to prove than, let's say, unlawful entry into a federal building. And you maybe don't get a conviction on the sedition charge, but you do on the others. But I think, look, prosecutors can't just take the safe road, the easy road. I'm not saying they should overcharge anything, but if the charge fits and the public need is there, and I think it is here, then you charge it. Now, let's talk a little bit more about Michael Sherwin. Ellie, young Ellie, let me advise you now. If you ever become a prosecutor, do not do this. Do not do what Michael Sherwin did. When I was a youngster at the SDNY, we were trained. They beat it into our heads. We were terrified to the point where if you ever got a call directly from the media, which we did, because journalists were hoping to find some young prosecutor who was willing to talk maybe on background, we were trained. If you ever get a call from the media, all you say is no comment, call the press office, click, right? And then they would call the press office and the press office would say no comment, click. And the main reason for that is prosecutors do not make extrajudicial statements about the merits of a case, especially a pending investigation like this. You don't do it because, first of all, it's bad form. It's a bad look. Prosecutors shouldn't be out there making prognostications and sort of dropping hints in the public about what they might do. You compromise your own investigation by doing that. There's a reason we prosecutors, grand juries, investigate in secret. You don't want people to know who you're looking at, what direction you're thinking of going. And finally, you could hurt your own case because you are potentially prejudicing your subjects, the people who you're investigating, who will raise a motion, and they've already started to do this in the wake of Michael Sherwin's comments, that he's out there saying things that are not in the public record that could be prejudicial to my client, could be prejudicial when we're trying to pick a jury someday. So it was just a complete lapse of judgment or a complete error, abuse, really, of his position by Michael Sherwin. He's now being investigated by DOJ internally, OPR, Office of Professional Responsibility, for breaking the rules. And I think he will be disciplined. So Ellie, let me ask you sort of for your initial reactions to the fact that Michael Sherwin gave this interview as a sitting prosecutor with DOJ. Did it strike you at the time as being anyhow wrong or improper?
Yes. And Ellie, what I've come to understand about the way that you develop a prosecutorial strategy is that there are opportunities from time to time to engage with the public. And I know that, for example, Preet Bharara became famous for some of his press conferences that he would give when you would bring charges. And so for me, I think, you know, setting aside the propriety of what prosecutor in this case did, it felt premature because there hadn't actually been charges brought yet. So, you know, normally you, I think, would wait for the investigation to conclude and you feel like you had the charges. Because, I mean, they're, you know, just simply announcing to the world, hey, and this as a general matter in prosecution, we're going to bring charges or we're thinking about bringing charges when the investigation hasn't concluded and there hasn't been a formal decision, has serious reputational, economic consequences and many other kinds of consequences for individuals and, you know, in the corporate context for corporations too.
Yeah, two good points there. First of all, it's good that you have that level of understanding as someone who's still in law school, because it takes a while, even as a prosecutor, to understand that everything you do has collateral consequences for the people you're investigating, for their families, for their employers, for their communities. And you have so much power. And if you sort of just throw around ideas and names willy-nilly out in the public, then you're doing undue damage to those people, to those communities. And it's a serious responsibility that takes a little bit to learn, even as a prosecutor. The second thing is we prosecutors like to say, We do our talking in court. We don't do our talking to 60 Minutes. We do our talking in our indictments, in our statements to juries, in our formal motions that we file with the court. Everything we do is on record. That is fine. And it's interesting that you raise this idea of the press conference, because prosecutors do sometimes get criticized by defense lawyers for having these press conferences. And of course, Preet didn't invent them. Prosecutors have been doing press conferences for a long time. He was very good at them and drew a lot of attention because the way he did it. But I want to make sure this is understood. Literally every word that is said by a prosecutor in the federal system, certainly in the SDNY, at a press conference is something that is already on the record, that is in the indictment, that is in the complaint, that is in something that you filed in the courtroom. When I say literally, I mean literally. I have sat there with Preet and with his predecessors going through every word they would say in the press release, every word they would say in their announcement, and they would go, where's this? And I would say, it's on page 6 of the indictment. Where's that? Oh, that's on page 14 of our bail memo, right? So the point is, anything that's being said at a press conference done correctly is something that we've already said, often in something filed that very day, but we're not saying anything beyond what's in the public record. And these are no longer pending investigations, right? These are people who've now been charged, and there's at least been a finding by a grand jury or a judge that there's probable cause they committed a crime. So it's a little different than getting out there throwing shade at people who have not yet been charged. But that's a really good observation. So let me run this by you now. Get your thoughts on this. Defense lawyers do this all the time. They go in front of the cameras. They hold courthouse steps, press conferences. They make inflammatory remarks. I mean, look, January 6th, the lawyer for, I hate to call him the shaman, but you know, this Jacob Chansley guy with the horns and the fur and all that, his lawyer is doing a full court press tour. And he's out there saying inflammatory things about the charges against his client, why they're inappropriate and why he's being picked on and why he should be the recipient of sympathy. Defense lawyers do that all the time and nobody really has any problem with it. And they certainly don't get disciplined by the judge or the bar or anything for doing that. So I guess in a sense, it feels like a double standard, but also there's a good argument that it's a very different situation. Give me your take on that. Why is it okay, or should it be okay, for defense lawyers to do media tours outside the record, but not prosecutors?
Ellie, I think it is okay and it should be okay. And, you know, you as a former prosecutor know the power to indict is the power to destroy. I mean, we just discussed this with some of the reputational, economic, and other collateral consequences that may run from the decision to prosecute or you know, ongoing prosecution. And our founders recognize this, right? The Bill of Rights establishes many, I think, procedural protections to check the state's prosecutorial power, the Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, and others in the criminal procedure context. But take a look at what happens during a criminal process, right? If one side wins, the defendant, everyone goes home. If the other side wins, the state takes away somebody's liberty or imposes some other, you know, formal consequence. We talked about some of the more informal consequences, but you know, there are formal consequences to losing a criminal case. So, I mean, as you talked about before, in terms of the checks on prosecutors, some of this gets worked out through internal procedure, some is constitutional. But I think one of the core rights of the individual in the society, and I think, you know, this flows from the constitutional text, is the right to protect yourself against government infringement.
I think that's exactly right. There is a double standard here, but I say that not by way of complaint. I actually think that's the right thing for our system for the reasons you talk about. It really goes back to the old thing, better to, you know, have a guilty person walk free than to convict an innocent person. I mean, you have to give extra consideration, extra protections to the defense side. Now, look, it used to make me nuts. I had lawyers doing this. I had lawyers out in the media throwing mud at us as prosecutors, accusing us of doing outrageous things that they wouldn't even have the guts to accuse us of in court, you know, playing up the sympathy card for their client. And it made me crazy because it felt so unfair. But in the bigger picture, I don't think you can prevent that unless it gets to an extreme scenario, which where judges sometimes impose gag orders, but they're very reluctant to do that. And I think it's part of the game. And I will tell you, there are various scenarios where the prosecutor has different obligations, different principles, different rules of play than a defense lawyer. I'll give you a couple scenarios that come up a lot. Number one, this idea of what we call Brady and Giglio evidence. And that refers to the obligation, the legal obligation that a prosecutor has to turn over evidence that may be helpful to the defendant, that may prove the defendant is in fact not guilty. Now, I don't believe there is any other brand of lawyer other than a prosecutor that has an affirmative obligation to turn over evidence that is bad for us and good for the other side, right? Defense lawyers certainly do not have that obligation. I mean, if a defense lawyer found a piece of evidence that was incriminating to his client, not only should he not turn it over, it would be malpractice to call the prosecutor and go, hey, I just want you guys to know there's this piece of evidence. It tends to show my client is guilty. That would be, you know, you'd be disbarred for that. Similarly, in civil practice, if you come across a piece of evidence that's bad for your side, good for the other side, it may come out as part of discovery, but you don't have an affirmative obligation to say, hey, other side, opponent, person on the other side of the V, here's something that's going to help you and hurt me. And do we bellyache about that a little bit as prosecutors? Yeah, of course. But is it right and the fair way to do things because of the liberty interest at stake? Absolutely. I'll give you one other example that's not quite by the book, but it happens. Defense lawyers at trial often throw in things in their jury addresses that they know will never be in evidence, or during closing that they know have not been admitted in evidence. I can't tell you how many times I've seen a defense lawyer stand up in opening or closing and announce to the jury that their client is a father of four and a grandfather of two, and he's suffering with cancer, by the way, and he donates a lot to charity. All of those things are irrelevant. They're just straight up sympathy plays. None of those things ever come in as evidence, but when defense lawyers do it, everyone just kind of says, what are you going to do, right? I mean, you can't stand up as a prosecutor and say, that's not in evidence. If you did the opposite as a prosecutor, if you dropped into a jury on closing facts that you never got in evidence, if you dropped in the fact that there was something negative about the defendant, that he had a drug problem, that he was having an affair, that he had a prior arrest, something like that, that was irrelevant and not in evidence, and you just dropped that into your closing, oh, God help you. It would be an immediate mistrial. You would be disciplined. You would be, all heck would break loose. So again, a double standard, but one that big picture doesn't make me crazy. Did it make me crazy when I was a prosecutor? Yes. But is it sort of all fair game now? I think more or less it is. What's your thoughts on that? The idea that there is a double standard of sort, but it's built into our system and it's probably a good thing.
I would fully agree with you. And I think in addition to some of the more procedural protections, this also impacts the way courts read laws. So in school, we've learned about something called the canon of lenity and the void for vagueness doctrine. Essentially, these are ways for courts to read laws in the criminal context, usually, in favor of defendants. And there's a whole body of jurisprudence on this with good reason for it, you know, as you mentioned, because of the liberty interest. The evidence laws, I think, have been developed with a keen focus on, well, in terms of the rights of the criminal defendant, how can we be protective in such a way, you know, that still allows us to advance the state's interest of prosecuting wrongdoing, but also vindicates, I think, an interest that the founders were very concerned with, and one that, you know, still folks who do constitutional law to this day and other types of law have a very strong interest in making sure it's protected. And Elia, I think that raises another question, and we do a lot of this against the backdrop of the trial by jury. Now, open question about how much of the criminal justice system gets worked out through plea bargaining, which I think is a growing question and concern. But in terms of the jury trial, I feel like you always have good stories. So I wanted to ask you this question. Have you ever had to dismiss a juror? And what is that process like?
Yeah. So really the concern, what's the concern with all this stuff, right? With prosecutors making extrajudicial statements to 60 Minutes and elsewhere. The concern is fundamentally that you're potentially contaminating the jury pool. Because if someday someone gets on a jury in this one of these January 6th trials and they think, oh, gee, but I remember that prosecutor went on 60 Minutes and he said this. Maybe it's not in evidence in the courtroom, but I remember seeing that. And the reality is we do have some protections in place against that. The jury selection process, right? The main question that jurors will be asked, especially in a high profile case, is, have you heard anything about this case? Have you formed any opinions that cannot be moved? And if and when these January 6th insurrectionists are tried, count on that happening and count on all of them saying, of course I've heard about this case. And then we'll have to get into this sort of next question. I dealt with that quite a bit because a lot of the cases I did were in the media, especially the mob cases, especially in New York City. You know, the tabloids, the fold-over newspapers tended to love our cases and put a lot of stuff about my trials in the papers. And we ran into little problems that we were usually able to sort out through jury selection, right? You would have people say, when I tried John Gotti Jr., a lot of people already had opinions about that. But I'll tell you one thing that always stuck with me. When I tried John Gotti Jr., it was the fourth time my office tried him. There were three prior trials way before my time. I got him on the fourth time. And when the jury ended up hanging, it was 6-6. Six wanted to convict, six wanted to acquit. And we ended up getting the rare chance to speak with the jury. And the jurors, it was more than one, I don't remember the exact number, but a couple of the jurors who were on the not guilty side said to us, essentially, oh, you guys definitely proved your case, but it's the fourth time he's being tried. That's not fair. You can't try someone four times. Now, that was never in evidence. They were not supposed to know that it was his fourth trial. Did they know that? Heck yes. I mean, they told us they knew that. Was it from seeing it in the papers? Did they go home and Google it? I don't know. But that is an extrajudicial fact. It was not part of the trial that they knew and clearly had a probably a determinative impact on at least some of them. So there is a real risk of that. And again, look, in our system, is it better that it happens in that scenario where somebody maybe gets off as opposed to convicted? I think that's preferable to the opposite scenario where a juror votes to convict somebody because they saw something like the Michael Sherwin interview outside of the courtroom. That is a nightmare scenario for us. Since you asked for a war story, I gave you one, but you know, I'm never shy with the old SDNY war stories. I did once have a bizarre situation where we tried another powerful mobster on a murder case and other charges. And right as the jury started deliberating, so we've already finished the trial at this point, one of the jurors sends a note directly to the judge, only from him. And he said, Judge, this is juror number whatever, and I need to speak with you directly and privately. And I said, oh, this can only be bad. It turned out that juror said to the judge, I did a little bit of digging on my own, and I learned some stuff about this defendant. He was already charged with murder. We proved up the murder. But he learned that the defendant, a guy named Angelo Prisco, had this sort of long history and was this very feared guy in the mob. And this juror said to the judge, Judge, I'm too scared to convict him because I don't know what he might do to me or my family. Now, the judge advised us of this, and I thought, well, this is a good news, bad news scenario. Good news is he obviously wants to convict. He obviously believes Prisco's guilty. Bad news is he's too terrified to actually do it. And the kicker was, the judge said, did you discuss any of this, what you read, with the jury? And the guy said, I might have mentioned it to a couple people. So now we've got multiple jurors potentially contaminated. The judge ended up removing this one juror, letting him out. We had alternates ready, right? That's why you have alternates in case you have a scenario like that. So they moved in. And then the judge essentially voir dired, questioned all the jurors again and reassured them that there's no risk to you personally and anything you've seen outside the courtroom, you should disregard. And that became, and the jury ended up convicting Prisco of murder and other charges. And that became a bit of an appellate issue, but the Second Circuit, the Court of Appeals, said it was fine the way it was handled. But I guess the point of these little stories is, yeah, this stuff does get through to jurors, especially on high-profile cases. And if and when we have trials relating to January 6th, you bet they're going to have heard about this. You bet some of them will have seen the 60 Minutes interview, and you bet they'll say they won't, but I am convinced they will Google, they will research, their human beings. So what do you make of all of that, Ellie?
Well, I think there are some things that do impact juries. There are some things that don't impact juries. There is a good amount of discussion, I think, among judges of what is the impact actually of a judge's instruction to a jury to disregard something. And in the case you just mentioned, there was an instruction, hey, disregard it, and you ended up getting a conviction. In a lot of cases, the judge will tell you, you know, hey, take that out of your mind, put that out of your mind. But that's really hard for people in practice to do. So I think you ask, well, what is the information at hand and will it actually have the impact that we fear it will have? Because we built up, I guess, a whole law of evidence to keep certain things out of trials because we either think it's not reliable or in the context of, for example, like privileges, spousal privileges, attorney-client and whatever else, there are other goals that we're trying to advance even you know, in the middle of a trial situation where we're trying to get the most reliable result.
There's a fascinating question of human psychology built into that, what you just talked about, which is when the judge says, okay, jury, you know, don't think about the pink elephant. All they're going to do is think about the pink elephant. And I'll tell you tactically, I if you ever end up doing trials, which I believe you may someday, I can see you in a courtroom, you will consider this. And I'll give you an example. What I said before, when the defense lawyer stands up at closing and announces that his client has overcome cancer and has donated millions to charity and has this enormous family who loves him and he's very religious. Technically, if you were doing a moot court workshop in law school, you would stand up and you would say, objection, Your Honor, facts not in evidence. And you would probably get a point from your moot court judge because you'd be right. In the real world, you don't, because you know the judge isn't going to do anything about it. And all you're going to do is signal to the jury, this upsets me. I don't want you to think about this. If anything, they're going to snap to attention and go, wait, what's he object? Oh, okay. It's all about having a bit of a poker face and taking yourself outside of what the rules of evidence say and what maybe you learn in your mock trial workshops in law school and getting into real life and real human psychology. And that is part of the reason why I loved doing trials so much and why I find the whole exercise so fascinating. So keep that in mind, Ellie. Get the points in your moot court. If you do moot court, I don't want you to lose points from the judges. But when you get into the real world, remember, it's all about actual humans and human psychology.
Well, wise Ellie, thank you as always for the opportunity. And also just want to give a quick shout out and thank you to your staff who have just been terrific.
It's a good crew. They know what's up. Ellie, thanks very much. And thank you to all our listeners for checking out this episode of Third Degree. Remember, please send us any thoughts or comments or questions at letters@cafe.com. Talk to you Monday. Third Degree is presented by Cafe Studios. Your host is Ellie Honig. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Adam Waller. The technical director is David Tatasciore. The audio and music producer is Nat Wiener. And the Cafe team is Matthew Billy, David Kurlander, Sam Ozer-Staten, Noah Azulai, Jake Kaplan, Jeff Eisenman, Chris Boylan, Sean Walsh, and Margot Malley.